Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. John Pham, you are somebody that, from day one, actually, of the podcast, I heard about you, and you are a professor out of Columbia, out of New York, and I've always wanted to have you on to talk about the origin of Vietnamese language. And you have a new book, The Lost Tongues of the Red River, that's come out, and we're here to share the ideas of the book, and we're also here to explore where Vietnamese language, in fact, comes from. So welcome to the Vietnamese podcast.
Thank you, Kenneth. It's a real pleasure to be here. I've heard about your podcast forever, and it's a real honor to participate in an episode. And I'm super excited to talk about the history of the Vietnamese language, which is something that I care very much about.
You know, we've talked about it, there being many chapters to this. I think that there are multiple angles to something as complicated as the Vietnamese language. So hopefully this is sort of like the anchor episode where we introduce you and we can sort of do sub-series that are similar to what I do with Kevin Pham with the Viet History Makers. So, you know, welcome aboard.
I love it. Yeah. Thanks.
Could you kind of give me, can share with me your journey into how you got interested in the Vietnamese language? Because I understand you're born here in America, right?
Yes, I am. Born and raised. I'm a Wisconsin boy. I'm from Madison, Wisconsin. So, yeah, well, I mean, it's a good question because I think where I arrived is really different from what compelled me to start the journey. You know, I started my academic studies, like many people, with sort of questions of identity. You know, I'm a Vietnamese American. As you said, I'm born in the U.S., grew up in the U.S., and had a natural curiosity, like many second-generation Vietnamese do, about where we came from and about the nature of where we came from. And of course, like growing up in a bilingual household, I always had an attention to language as a medium of culture, language as a way of transmitting culture or transmitting identity. So I think I started studying Vietnamese language, the history of the language and the nature of the language, because I wanted to understand what it meant to be Vietnamese or what it meant for me to be Vietnamese. And then the journey really took me to a very different place. If you read the introduction to the book, and I'm sorry, I don't have a copy of the book with me to show you, but if you read the introduction, you'll see that I talk a lot about how identity or questions of identity can actually confuse us, can obscure the nature of language. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't tell us about what it means to be Vietnamese. It just means that it reveals to us actually how much we invest in the idea of language when we think about our identities. But I think that's where I started.
Can you curiosity. Why it confuses us?
Yeah, I think it's because, well, language is really emotional. And it is completely, deeply linked to who we are. We perform who we are. We perform our individual identities through our languages, through our language. And we perform our cultural identity through language. And of course, virtually every aspect of language is expressed. I'm sorry, every aspect of culture is expressed in linguistic terms, you know. So we have this idea that language is this kind of this vehicle for cultural identity. And that's not wrong. The thing is, we tend to think that language is a vehicle for the way in which we think identity is constructed. Mm. But language is actually a much better record or a much better expression of language. I'm sorry, language is a much better expression of culture than we think it is, because it actually betrays all the different dimensions of our identity and our culture, especially the diversity of our culture and identities that we might not necessarily be conscious of. So I know that's a lot of words. What I really mean by that is that we have a romantic idea. We have an idea of our identity and our culture. It's like a story. It's a beautiful story, and it's usually a very important story, and we invest a lot of emotion in that story, because when we construct that story, we're making sense of who we are. And then we think that language is the proof that that story is true. But language actually contains that story and tells us even more. It tells us the actual history, the actual development, the actual diverse origins and diverse pathways by which our identity emerged. So that's why language confuses us, because we want it to confirm the story we tell ourselves about our cultural identity. But it does more than that. It actually tells us the whole rich history of where identities come from.
Now I'm curious to hear, when along this journey of linguistics, did you come up with that idea? Did you stumble upon this feeling that it confuses us? I mean, because it makes perfect sense, but it's like, you know, you have to like be climb up this mountain forever, and then you kind of like over time begin to see it. But that's not obvious right away.
Yeah, thanks for asking that question, because I also want to point out that is also not the real subject of the book. The subject of the book is the actual history of the language, you know, what the influences are, particularly what the Sinitic or Chinese influences are and how it developed. So most of the bulk of the work is there. But as we talked about a minute ago, I started that journey with questions of identity. Mm. So when I went through that work, it compelled me to think again about what all of this linguistic knowledge or what all of this linguistic inquiry tells us in fact about identity. So I didn't really understand those things until I went through that journey of the linguistic analysis and learned, for example, the science of linguistics, what linguistics as a science can do and can show to us. And once I went through that, then I went back and I thought about, well, what does this mean for all of my personal feelings about the Vietnamese language, or my personal feelings about what it means to be Vietnamese? And then I did a little bit of more thinking at that point. And I hope that that's a place where people who are not necessarily interested in linguistics can engage with the book and the subject, because I think it's a good consequence or even accident of the work that I did on the history of the Vietnamese language. It may be even, from some perspectives, the most important aspect of the work that I did.
Which came before, the understanding of Vietnamese to you, like syntactically, grammatically, and vocabulary? Did all of that precede your study of linguistics, or did linguistics come first and you started to build and mount sort of more knowledge with Vietnamese?
Yeah. Well, like many people, I didn't understand anything about what linguistics actually was when I first started. I didn't even understand what the field was until after I started the PhD. After I graduated from college, I moved to Hanoi to study Chữ Nôm, you know, the sort of old morphograph, the Sinitic style script that was used to represent Vietnamese language before the alphabet. And that started me on this path of asking questions about language. But it wasn't until I got to Cornell, where I did my PhD, where I took my first linguistics class, and I realized that linguistics is a science, and as a science, it does not care about cultural identity at all. I mean, it does, yeah, because culture is a force on the development of language, but it treats language as this object that can be put under the microscope. And that was really freeing. You know, it was a kind of revelation to realize that we can take questions of identity and put them aside for a moment and just look objectively at the object, you know, of the Vietnamese language and study its nature, its structure, and its history. So I started out with those questions about Vietnamese. I set them aside. I learned what linguistics was. And then I came back to those questions. And now at that point, as I think as you're asking, I had spent a lot of time studying the structure of the Vietnamese language as it relates to other related languages and things like that.
Yeah. Wow, that is so fascinating to be in Vietnam studying Chữ Nôm. Can you kind of describe those years? Because as a Vietnamese American born in America, that journey sounds really thrilling to somebody like me. It sounds it's a privilege to go to Vietnam and to really dig up the records of where our language kind of evolved and originated from. Can you tell me a little bit about that time?
Yeah, it was a total privilege and it was life-changing. I received a Fulbright Fellowship when I graduated from college, and my proposal was to study Du Nhoam to learn it. And I studied with probably the most renowned expert of Nhoam today. His name is Nguyen Quang Hồng. He's based in Hanoi. And I was probably his worst student. That's what I say. Like, there's two of us who we vie for the honor of being his worst student. I definitely was a really bad student, but I learned a lot as a 21-year-old, 22-year-old kid. And I remember, first of all, first time in Vietnam. I was born in the U.S. First time experiencing, living in Vietnam, in Hanoi, in this case. And I remember, kind of the thought of like how big Vietnam or Vietnamese culture is, because I grew up with all of these, concepts of what Vietnamese cultural identity were. A lot of those things had to do with things like, I think we talked about last time we talked, like things that are not even Vietnamese, like the TV series Anh Hùng Sát Điêu, the martial arts. I thought that as quintessentially Vietnamese because it was just something my family and I watched together so many times, So, and then of course, food and all these other things. So moving to Vietnam for the first time and having those ideas in my mind, thinking, oh, Vietnamese must mean these things. And then seeing a completely different Vietnam, not a Southern Vietnam for one, and, a contemporary Vietnam, not Vietnamese America. And then on top of all of that, learning Du Nhoam, which is a script that expresses a world that almost doesn't exist. Things are better now, but in 2002, when I first learned it, there were only a handful of scholars who could read Nhoam. Not because it's particularly difficult, but just because people had ceased to really care about it. And yet for centuries and centuries and centuries, both Chữ Hán, literary Chinese and Chinese characters, and Chữ Nhoam, Nhoam characters for representing the Vietnamese language, everything that had to do with Vietnamese culture and literature was expressed in those two scripts and those two languages. So it was kind of dizzying to be in Vietnam in a moment when the connection to that past had almost been lost. Now, things are different now. There are many incredible scholars of Vietnamese. And that's thanks to people like Nguyen Quang Hồng, who kept that tradition of scholarship alive all the way through that period. But that's sort of a chief memory of mine at that moment, just sort of being like, whoa, Vietnam is more. It's way more and way more diverse and way more capacious than I thought of. And it was an exciting and, as you say, a great privilege to discover that.
I think about the academic, the books that are a struggle here in America, book banning and the politics that are involved in what text to kind of promote and push. And I think about that chasm perhaps between Chữ Hán and Chữ Nhoam and the politics. Yeah. Did you experience any of that? Was there any politics? And I don't even mean Vietnamese American and Vietnam politics. I'm just saying within the academic sort of circles, it just seems like there could be a lot of fuzziness around all of the borders that are we Chinese? Or do we come from China? All of that seems to be such a contentious, could be a contentious direction.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a question I care a lot about, and I spend a lot of time thinking and talking about with people, because it is one of those issues that really prevents, tragically, I think, all sorts of people, Vietnamese people, Chinese people, all sorts of people from recognizing and appreciating the sort of richness of culture that we can lay claim to. So you put your finger on it. The line between what we call China and Vietnam is the most contentious issue. And yes, let me start with just the effect of that. So the effect of that on scholarship is that things that have been considered quote unquote Chinese have largely been ignored over the past many decades of Vietnamese studies. Things like the entire corpus of, I would call it, Vietnamese literature that's written in what we call Văn Ngôn, the which is literary Chinese, you know, because there's this perception that, oh, it's written in the Chinese language, so how can it actually be Vietnamese? Despite the fact that for centuries, that language was felt to be more authentically Vietnamese than writing in Chữ Nôm, you know. So that's one consequence. Other things like archaeological sites, the entire historical period of the first millennium, you know, these things are considered to be part of Chinese studies or Chinese history, and therefore they're just not focused on, not only in Vietnam, but also in the West. In Vietnam, for obvious reasons, because of a sort of a nationalist history, a history of nationalism as it exerts itself upon the fields of scholarship, but in the West also because Vietnamese studies arose over the Cold War in the West. And during the Cold War, there was this great emphasis among Western scholars to divide the world up into Cold War components, including East versus Southeast Asia, and certainly China versus the West. So Vietnam was, of course, quote unquote, Southeast Asian. And there was this dive into the indigeneity of Southeast Asia, which means that Western scholars for many decades, they cared about things like Đông Sơn, things like the bronze drums of the quote-unquote pre-Sinitic past, because that's indigenous to Southeast Asia. And they did not care about things like the long millennium during which northern Vietnam was an integral part of the quote-unquote Chinese empires. In fact, the site of the largest city in the south of the Han Dynasty. But luckily, there were some great scholars of Vietnamese studies who did that work anyway, you know, and who laid the groundwork for what I think is a real flourishing today. But I'm getting sidetracked. You're right. This is a big issue. It's difficult. And I think the real issue is that all of us today, we think of our identities. Well, not all of us, but most of us, many of us, we define our identities, whether we want to or not, in a semi-nationalist sensibility. And by that, I mean a zero-sum way. If I am Vietnamese, I'm not Chinese. If I'm French, I'm not Italian. You know, if I'm Japanese, I'm not Korean. And that means there's no room for complexity or diversity or shared history. So a thing like Aozai, for example, yeah, maybe there's a history where the Aozai has something to do with a Chinese garment. But we have to think of the Aozai as purely Vietnamese, and we have to construct a story by which it represents the difference between China and Vietnam. And if you're always thinking about culture or identity, or especially language, in those terms, you're always trying to get culture, society, history, or language to serve the purpose of expressing the difference or uniqueness of what you think of as your own identity, you're never going to be seeing clearly, you know? And I think the real tragedy of that is that you're going to miss so much of the richness that is there, that is part of our heritage. And just because a thing is shared doesn't mean that we can't claim it. You know, that's the main point. So I make this point a lot in my book because I say, oh, you know, this period of history, you know, we shouldn't think of it as Chinese or Vietnamese. You know, we should think of it as its own thing that is a progenitor of modern Vietnamese culture. But when I say that, I mean that Chinese people should also not think of it as Chinese, you know? They should think of it as something different that maybe led in a different pathway towards what is modern-day Chinese culture. So this is a sensitive issue. But I think it's one that if we just take a little care about, if we set aside the need to just play that team sports kind of identity, like I'm on team A versus team B, then we can start to see actually how rich and how diverse, you know, our own identities can be.
Hi, I'm Terry Schmidt, a registered dietitian and host of On Nutrition, a podcast from Mayo Clinic where we dig into the latest nutrition trends and research to help you understand what's health and what's hype. There's a lot of wild stuff out there, so we'll be keeping it science-based, research-informed, and practical. Mayo Clinic's On Nutrition. New episodes every other week, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for that.
Thank you for that.
The more I think about this, the more I explore it, the more I talk to people, I can't help but to think about how much Chinese culture is inside of Vietnamese culture. It's just
for sure
apparent. Yeah. And to deny that or to not want to talk about that, it just feels icky and uncomfortable to me, because that's like saying it's analogous to something like, you know, the early, you know, United States had nothing to do with Britain. And then nobody's saying that. Nobody's saying that. But, you know, the language comes from, you know, it just feels that way. But I know that there's a departure mm-hmm. in the work that you are talking about now. There's a departure that says, okay, like this whole idea of Chinese to Vietnamese, now let's get into the weeds. Let's get into the nuance of where the differences began to happen. And I'd like to talk about that with you. Because for me, if I said to the world, you know, people who are not Vietnamese or Chinese, and I just said, you know, oh, Vietnamese comes from the Chinese culture, that would not be entirely, that's not true. There's a lot to correct there. And I'd love to start to get into that right now.
Yeah. I mean, you're asking really great questions. So I think it's so interesting to think like how much of the contention has to do with very silly things. Before I say what I was about to say, I will say that there is a real basis for that contention and it real feelings and real trauma. And always the more immediate source of those feelings, they're more modern than we think. So we tend to say in Vietnamese circles, oh, the Vietnamese have been fighting the Chinese for, you know, 2,000 years, you know, going all the way back to Hai Ba Tieu, you know, Hai Ba Tieng, et cetera. And that's not an accurate statement for many reasons, but the Vietnamese did fight a war with the Chinese in the late 70s and the early 80s. And also a few hundred years before that, the Vietnamese did fight a really important war with the Ming Dynasty. The Ming conquered Vietnam for 20 years or so. So there are more recent historical memories on which these feelings are based that are valid and real. But then we sort of amplify them into these grander stories. And that's where, as you say, things need to be corrected a little bit. But that said, so much of what makes it difficult and contentious do have to do with silly things like how we refer to China and Vietnam. So the example I like to give sometimes is France or other Western European countries, because France has no problem claiming Rome as part of their heritage. You know, the Roman Empire, the Latin language, French is a Romance language, etc. And there's a lot of reasons why there's no problem. They have no problems with that. But part of there are two I would like to pull out. One is that, and the big one, of course, is that the Roman Empire fell. And we never equate Italy with the Roman Empire today because it's this tiny part. Even though it was the heart, it's just this tiny part of what used to be the Roman Empire. Whereas when you compare the history of Asia, the Chinese empires fell many times but always reconstituted themselves. But the key thing to remember here is that each time the Chinese empires reconstituted themselves, they were reborn into something new and different. So the way in which Vietnam has sort of been influenced, quote unquote, by China or Chinese culture is very similar, I would argue, to the way in which France locates one of the fonts of its culture in the Roman Empire. But they just don't have this modern problem of claiming that because there's no modern Roman Empire. Right. So that's one thing. Right. And the second thing is also part of that, you know, they call the Roman, and this is the silly one. I mean, we call the Roman Empire the Roman Empire. We don't call it Italy. We call that language Latin. We don't call it ancient Italian, you know? And to bring the point home, for example, we don't call the Western calendar the Roman calendar or the Italian calendar or the New Year the Italian New Year, you know? But in Asia, we call literary Chinese, literary Chinese. Actually, in Vietnamese, we don't, but you tend to call it Văn Ngôn, which just means the literary language. But, you know, when we say Chữ Hán, for example, we're identifying it as Chinese. And of course, we have this confusion of the pre-modern Chinese empires with modern China. And those are totally different things. Right. And again, to bring the calendar to as the example, so many people call it the Chinese New Year, Lunar New Year as the Chinese New Year. Which, you know, there's maybe some reason to do that, but it's exactly like calling the Western New Year, the Italian New Year. I mean, the Lunar New Year, you know, is a thing that was part of a culture that is Sinitic in origin, but has as much to do with modern Vietnam as it has to do with modern China. And all of these confusions are sort of extensions of the basic fact that we think of all of quote-unquote Chinese history as belonging to exclusively to modern, to the history of the modern PRC, the modern People's Republic of China. And that is what I was calling that team sports kind of way of thinking about identity. If it's this team, then it's not this team, you know? So if it belongs to China, it can't belong to us, you know? But we just got to get that out of our heads, you know, and realize that there were these ancient cultures and that were Sinitic or Chinese, if you want to call them that. And so much of what Vietnam is came out of those cultures the same way. So much, not all, but so much of what became France, what became Spain, what became Portugal came out of the Roman Empire. You know, so that's the idea.
Actively figure out how to kind of let the public know that this is something that we need to kind of strangle. We need to, now, I mean, not strength, strength is not the word. It's more like control over or pass along this sort of nuance.
Well, I think, you know, like, I think the main thing that people are afraid of is that they will lose, that we will lose the right to call something ours, you know, and the right to be proud of something or the right to celebrate something as part of our identity. And I think the main thing to communicate is that we don't have to be afraid of that, you know, because it's still ours. It's still Vietnamese, you know. In fact, it allows us to claim more. It allows us to understand a broader range of where Vietnam and Vietnamese culture comes from. You know, and again, the flip side of what I'm saying is that we have to have a conversation about how modern China cannot own everything, you know, that is quote unquote Chinese in history. You know, it has to be a shared thing, just like Italy doesn't have, you know, cannot claim everything that is Roman, you know? So I think if we tell people that, you know, I'm not asking you to give up on the idea that a Vietnamese identity exists. I'm asking you, you know, I'm saying that we can be more capacious about that. We can see that Vietnamese identity is richer and more complex and more diverse. Then I think that a lot of that fear goes away. And then I think if you can do that, if you can get people to see, you know, that all identities are like this. All identities are tapestries or mosaics. They're comprised of many different parts that overlap with other identities. Then there's a kind of miracle that happens, which is that you see that you're unique and distinctive. And I do think it's unique and distinctive. Your unique and distinctive identity is miraculously connected to virtually all the other cultures and identities on Earth. And that is a good thing. And I think it's a better thing than to invest in a notion of identity that requires separateness, that requires a zero-sum way of defining yourself, you know. And I think people are ready for that. I think they are. I think we all are. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, this brings up sort of a modern issue, I think, that you and I probably lived through with our parents, is that many of them probably think our Vietnamese pre-75 was Jordan, was the way to speak. And then the modern Vietnamese today are, you know, 100 million people are speaking the wrong language. We have the right way of looking at it because we come from the correct way of speaking Vietnamese, which I think many times when I hear that, it's just absolutely ludicrous when I hear that. But again, I can't throw out the entire argument, just simply because I want to honor, you know, our previous generation's idea of loss. You should probably have a point of view about that, because I'd love to hear it.
Yeah. Well, let me preface this by saying I totally love the pre-75, both the pre-75 Hanoi dialect, well, actually the pre-54 Hanoi dialect, which still survives in little pockets in Hanoi, although the standard Hanoi dialect today is very Nam Dinh. It's a totally different dialect. But it still survives. I love it. Just for totally biased reasons. And I also really love the pre-75
nostalgic reasons.
Saigon dialect, that sort of buttery Saigon dialect that I wish I had that accent and I don't. So let me show myself as being a hypocrite by saying I totally love those dialects. And I, you know, I think that they're beautiful. And I catch myself sometimes being like, oh, this is the real Hanoi. This is the real, you know, the real, et cetera, which is totally hypocritical. But those are feelings, you know. But yeah, I mean, I think what you're putting your finger on is, again, that thing where we think of language as the place where we perform, express, and define our identities. And therefore, when tragedies occur or when communities undergo transformations, sometimes traumatic transformations, language is also the place where it becomes a line in the sand, you know, where we try to preserve or defend what we think of as the identity that is under threat, you know? And once again, language always betrays that effort because language will always change no matter what. So it is true, certainly, if you speak to communities in the US, we maintain a pre-75 vocabulary. And the biggest, I would say the most salient feature of that is the Sinitic, in fact, the Chinese, the Sinitic vocabulary of pre-75 Vietnamese, because after the Third Indochina War, the Vietnamese government in the 80s initiated this campaign to try to just get rid of all the Chinese words in the Vietnamese language, which is why pre-75 Vietnamese, we say Phi Trường, which is Phi Trường in modern China. Phi Chi Trường is the airport. And they say Sân Bay, exactly. Sân Bay. And the joke about that effort is that you know, they could not change Hồng Thập. You know, Hồng Thập is the Red Cross. And they changed it to Thập Đỏ, which is only 50% successful because Thập is still a Chinese word. So that's the point. The point here is that we always want to control language because we want it to do what we wanted to do. We wanted to express our specific concept of our own identities, but it's always better expressing our real identities because it's a natural thing that will always change. And the same thing goes for pre-75 dialects in the US. Like there are pockets of Vietnamese language spoken. Certainly it's conservative in the US, but in the places where it's still a living language among young people, it becomes this changing thing. And what's really interesting is that it's in contact via the internet with modern dialects in Vietnam. So especially, you know, there's really interesting studies by some former students of ours about pronouns that are being used now. The one, it's probably already out of date, but the one that I hear both in California and in Saigon is chang, like lemon, lime, you know, chang, which is a gender neutral pronoun. It's both chi and ang. Yeah. So that's happening. So like, no matter how much you want to try to control language, it will always change to reflect the actuality, you know, of usage.
Oh my God, I love that pronoun.
Yeah. Shout out to Celia Bui, a former student of ours who works for the Endangered Language Association here in New York. She is, she worked on that set of pronouns while she was here. So shout out Celia. Sorry, go on.
This is amazing. You know, we have the idea of this Red River, and it's in the title of your book. Yes. What does the Red River people have anything to do with this equation that we're talking about right now?
Yeah. Great. Now we're getting into the actual content of the book. Yeah. So the Red River is often thought of as the cradle of Vietnamese civilization or culture. And that's because the major city, the major urban sites for most of Vietnamese history were in the Red River Plain. It's like a conservative way of thinking about identity, but it has a very ancient history. So of course, if you're working backward from the modern period, especially if you're coming from the South, the presence of Vietnamese speaking peoples in the South only dates to the 17th century, 16th, 17th century, when what we would call today Qing peoples, you know, increasingly invaded and then eventually conquered Champa, this big, very important, powerful, and old kingdom in what is now central Vietnam. And then eventually took over the Mekong Delta. Those are the Nguyen clan, who established a very different kind of kingdom in the south.
Okay.
And southern Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
I got to interrupt again. So these people slowly make their way north to defeat the Ciampa, right?
South, yeah. Mm-hmm.
They go south or north?
They're going south. So these are King. These are Vietnamese-speaking peoples coming from what is now modern-day northern Vietnam, going south to conquer parts of Ciampa, yes.
Okay, but the Red River is in the south, right?
No, the Red River is in the north. Hanoi is on the Red River. Got yeah. It. Yeah, sorry.
And so you're saying, or people are saying that that is the cradle of Vietnamese. Where did they come from?
Yeah, so this is the reason why. So the people who colonized Ciampa and eventually the Mekong Delta, what is now central and southern Vietnam, the Nguyen clan, as we call them, the Nguyen clan, they were originally from Thanh Hóa and part of the kingdom of the Vietnamese kingdom that we call Đại Việt, which is the kingdom that existed from around the 10th century all the way through the 20th century, you know, in various forms, but basically centered on the Red River Plain. So this was a clan of that culture or society or civilization. And then there was, you know, a civil war and they kind of fled south and established a new kingdom in the south. This is So depending on how you count, you can think of southern cultural identity as starting in that moment when a new kind of society and culture was established in the south. But of course, that society and culture also has roots in the north, you know, because that clan was originally from the north and they spoke Vietnamese. They brought with them Vietnamese-style Buddhism, Confucianism, etc. It was utterly transformed in the south, but it had its roots in the north. I mean, I don't want to make crass historical comparisons. It's one of my favorite things to do, but you have to do it with care. But like, it's a little bit like if you think about, as you said earlier, like American culture is rooted in British culture. So the South is rooted in the North in that way, but it became utterly transformed in the South. But that's why we call the Red River Plain the heartland or the cradle, because the way in which the Kingdom of Đại Việt thought of itself was as an extension of the culture that arose in the Red River Plain. And where did that culture come from? Well, the capital of the first independent, well, if you don't count Ninh Bo Linh, which is in the 10th century, the first long-lasting independent dynasty of Vietnam is the Lý dynasty in the 11th century. So the capital of that dynasty is in the Red River Plain. It's near Hanoi. And then every capital of Đại Việt was around that area for the rest of history. And why? Because before that period, in the thousand-year period before that, during which time area of northern Vietnam is part of the Chinese empires, the Red River Plain, the area around Hanoi, was the site of the largest, quote-unquote, Chinese city of those empires. It was, for most of history, called Zhaoqi, but there are many different names of it. So, you know, that's why the book is called Lost Tongues of the Red River, because we're talking about languages that were spoken in the Red River, especially before or up until the rise of the Lý dynasty in the second millennium. I know that was a kind of, yeah, weird,
great,
long-ranging answer. Go ahead. Yeah.
I know, and we need to hear that because you just said all that, it made me think about when we were kids, all you thought about was like, we were superheads and gooks that came from like the jungles. That literally what I was thinking about who I was my entire life up until starting to do this work. I thought that we were jungle people without labels.
Yeah.
That we didn't have a history. I truly believe that. I really did not think that our lives were worth much. We were just a byproduct of this big war. And that's what happens when you're growing up and you don't know. And your parents are working and they don't really have the time or nor probably my dad might have. But the essence, the foundation, in Vietnamese, we call it give home, right? The principle, the ideas to give to their kids and say, no. There's a lot of history and layers in where we come from. And to hear you like go off on a tangent on like explaining all that, I do wish that we do spend subsequent episodes talking about all of the things in more detail, because we can get down to the nitty gritty. And it's so important that we as Vietnamese Americans, second generation to third to fourth generation, begin to really uncover these things. And I think people in Vietnam, you know, are also interested in too, with this history as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I had the same experience growing up, you know. And some of my favorite memories are when those small, narrow, hemmed in impressions of my own identity were busted open, you know, like the first, you know, the weird, you know, because so much of the book has to do with China, I'll give you an example of a Chinese kind of example, because as a Vietnamese person, you know, who has roots in the South, my entire concept of what Chinese meant was Cantonese, for sure. You know, like, and when I took my first Chinese class, I was like, what the hell is this language? I mean, it doesn't sound anything like Chinese. Mandarin seemed so alien, you know? You know, and the same thing when I moved to Hanoi. I mean, my image of Vietnam was the South. You know, it was Saigon and the Mekong and all of those Hollywood images as well of this steamy jungle. And then I, you know, to be freezing, back then winters were still cold, to be freezing in Hanoi, you know, like in December and January, you know, those are really precious moments because they crack open the small thing that you're told that you are. And they allow you then to sort of realize there's just, as you said, there's just so much more that I am free to claim as part of my identity, you know, which is, again, not to beat a dead horse, but this is why I find it tragic when we are so selective about our own identities, because we're playing a team sport. We don't want to claim this. We want to reject that because we want to essentially fight. You know, we want to essentially draw lines between each other. And if we don't do that, then there's this huge range, you know, and it makes you feel the richness of identity.
You know? I think a lot of modern Vietnamese Americans are caught up in this. You know, whether it's Republican or Democrat or Vietnamese America, Vietnamese communist government, there's all of these things that if we take moments to think about how similar we all really are versus the small details, how different we are, I think it will create more understanding, more range, as you call it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think it's one of those things that we always do have to remember, that a lot of why we tend to do this as humans is because of pain or suffering or loss, you know? So like when there is suffering of that type, I think we get defensive about our identities, you know, because we feel like they're threatened, you know? So, you know, I do think it's a tragedy, but it's also like it's a delicate thing because there are reasons why we act this way, you know, so, and legitimate reasons. So it's one of those things. So I think if we can just start to let go of the fear that we're going to be erased, you know, then we can start embracing, as you say, you know, that diversity.
One thing that we did not talk about the last time, what we haven't spoken about, and maybe we could just touch lightly on it, is I think there's 53 quote unquote tribes of
54.
And so the king is the 54th, or what? There's 53 and then king, right?
I suppose that's up my hand.
How are these other 53 compared to the 54 linguistically related? Are they related at all, or do they come from different places?
That's a great question. So, caveat, 54 is a relatively arbitrary number. I mean, the government had to come up with a kind of categorization, but you can count in many different ways. So it could be more, it could be less than 54. A lot of them are related. So if you're talking linguistically, just linguistically, so culturally it's different, but linguistically, a lot of them are related. They're the family of languages in those groups that are related to the Vietnamese language are the Muong languages, M-U-O-N-G, not Hmong, not Hmong, but Muong. Mm. And the Muong languages themselves are comprised of many different diverse languages. Part of my dissertation research was on the Muong languages. They're mostly spoken in Phu Tho, Thanh Hóa, and Hòa Bình today, in the sort of north center, south of the Red River. And they're not really mutually intelligible with Vietnamese. They're kind of like Portuguese and Spanish, or Spanish and Italian. Like, if you spend a week with a Muong person, depending on their dialect, you might start to be able to communicate. But it's a good reminder because culture and language don't always go hand in hand in an iron, you know, relationship. So many of the Hmong peoples today are culturally closer to Tai, to the Kra-Dai peoples. So the biggest, another big group of those ethnic minorities are Kra-Dai speaking peoples. Kra-Dai is the language to which modern day Tai and Lao belong, right? And there are many different Kra-Dai speaking peoples, what we call Tai in Vietnamese, Tai peoples in the highlands. And they have exerted an enormous cultural influence over the Hmong, also over the Vietnamese, but especially over the Hmong. So, but they are not linguistically related to Vietnamese. Then in the north, there's a big group of Hmong-Mien languages. That's another big group of the 54. And then there's a huge number of other languages, other Southeast Asian language groups spoken in the south and center, including Cham, the Cham languages that are vestiges of that kingdom, you know, that was conquered. Of course, Khmer, many other groups like the Jurai. I should also mention, there are non-Hmong related languages as well. The most ancient, the most conservative Vedic languages are also part of those 54 ethnic minority groups. So it's a stunning array, and just a sliver of them are related to the Vietnamese language. But of course, the Vietnamese language is the most populous speaker population today because of it's the national
language. Is there any work or research that relates to how those languages kept their sort of stayed intact, and why did the Viet King people, why did our language become the dominant forced language?
Yeah. Oh man, you're asking really good, like meaty and really complicated questions. This is a really difficult one. So, because it rubs up against another kind of beautiful story that we tell ourselves, which there's some truth to it, but it's also misleading. And that story is, the Vietnamese language survived 1,000 years of Chinese domination, right? That's a very common thing that we say. And it's not totally untrue, because the Vietnamese language is not, it's not genealogically related to Chinese. So the language that we speak today descends from a language that has nothing to do with the Chinese language. Yes. So it's what's called an Austroasiatic language. It's a language related to Khmer, Cambodian, and many other languages of mainland Southeast Asia. But it doesn't look like any of those languages because it's been completely transformed by Chinese and Thai influence. So that's why it's both true and untrue to say that the Vietnamese language survived. It did in some sense, but it's been completely transformed. And what we call the Vietnamese language, this is the real crux of my book. What we call the Vietnamese language was born as the result of contact between Chinese and the ancestor of the modern Vietnamese language. So that's a long way of answering your question. So now when we turn to ethnic minority languages, I wanted to start by saying that because we tend to have this romantic notion that languages survive because cultures are strong or cultures are defiant. And that's not really true. Languages, first of all, language and culture don't always go together. And second of all, cultures can survive when languages don't, and vice versa. Languages can survive when cultures don't, and they just transform. And the reality is languages are always the practical result of power, you know? So power structures in society. So why, for example, when we think about an example like Mexico, like the native Mexicans, Mexico was a very diverse place under the Aztec Empire, but most of the native Mexicans under the Aztec Empire were either Maya speaking or Nahuatl speaking. That was the language of the Aztecs. And most people in Mexico today speak Spanish. That doesn't mean that Aztec or Maya culture is weak or undefiant. And it doesn't mean that Aztec or Maya culture is absent from Mexican culture. Mexican culture is definitively Aztec and Maya, you know? Mm. So you don't want to overstate, you don't want to romanticize the quote unquote survival of language, because language is always the result of practical situations. So to answer your question about the ethnic minorities, the first way to answer it is that many ethnic minorities did not keep their language. So the Hmong peoples. So in a sense, you can think about once Vietnamese existed, it was the prestige language of the Dyvet kingdom. Everyone spoke it, you know, and the Dyvet kingdom was a lowland kingdom and it conquered across the plains of the rivers. So everywhere the king people went, king means capital, right? So in this case, the capital is the big city on the Red River Plain, the area around Hanoi, what we would call Thang Long, you know, in the past. The people of Thang Long, the king people from Thang Long, spread out and they conquered and they absorbed all the other peoples. And so all those ethnic minorities who lived at a level, an elevation level that were prone to that cultural assimilation, they didn't keep their language. They switched. They switched to Vietnamese, which is why today what we call Mường is only spoken at a higher elevation because they're just a little bit further away. And where are the ethnic minorities that speak those languages? They're all in the Midlands or the Highlands. And also it draws attention to a good point today. You know, those languages are disappearing all over the place because of the spread of Vietnamese, and the same in China, the same in many places around the world, the same in the history of Europe as well. And that is both a tragedy and supernatural. No, I don't mean supernatural. I mean, very, very natural. It's a tragedy because it's kind of like species, biological species dying out. It's like this language is dying out. That language is dying out. We're losing it, right? We're losing the diversity. But also it's super normal because it's like societies work that way. If you want to have a functioning society, you need a communicatory system. You need a unified system, you know, like, so, you know, to get ahead, you have to learn that language and to, you know, and therefore as a natural result, you have a homogenization and you have languages dying out. So it's a real two-edged sword, you know. Once again, I'm going on tangents, but to just to summarize all the things that I just said, languages only survive as a matter of practical social power. And so when we look at the diversity of Vietnamese languages today or languages of Vietnam today, we see much of that diversity is in the highlands where the sort of lowland civilization, which is King speaking, which is Vietnamese speaking, did not absorb, you know? So I don't know, you know, if that answers your question or not.
It really clears it up. I've always thought about that. I'm like, well, how did this one thing survive, quote unquote, the other 53 things, you know? Like, how did that ever happen? And now I get it. I kind of understand. But it brings me to this other thing where, like, when I think about all the things you're saying and when I hear you talk, it's kind of like all these topics are like whack-a-moles, you know, like there's so many different directions that you can go down. And I can imagine you coming up with all of these sort of like you stumble upon all these things that you have to discover and fortify your arguments and everything like that. But I can also imagine a world in which you live in that has a lot of people challenging you. Does that come up? Because as I'm listening to you, I'm going, wait, this could go a lot of different directions in my mind, right? So I'm wondering the challenges and the academic world, how many people are, you know, up in arms about, oh, the things that you're saying? Or are you going with the flow of the river here? Or, you know, are you in line with your contemporaries?
That's another difficult question. So I think, yeah, there are a lot of challenges. There's plenty of people who hate me. I would say there are at least two different batches of disagreement. So there are legitimate is the right word. There are legitimate scholarly, linguistic, scientific criticisms to my work that I think are right. For example, my book treats the influence of Sinitic languages or Chinese languages on the origin of the Vietnamese language, but it does not treat the influence of Kra Dai languages on the origin of the Vietnamese. And, you know, a couple scholars have really pointed that out, and they're totally right. Like, it is a real lack. It's a real hole in my scholarship. And that has nothing to do with politics. They're correct. You know, we can only do so much. And another little shout out, there's a student named Granger from the University of University of Washington, Seattle, just finished a dissertation focused on exactly that issue, the role of Kra Dai as well as Sinitic on the development of Vietnamese. So there are legitimate critiques like that. And then very hopefully there are new students and scholars who are emerging who are taking our work and taking it further and fixing those holes, which I think is great. Now, on the other hand,
can I stop you real quick?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So sorry. So, did you know about those that argument before you finished the book, or did you not think? I mean, you had to have.
No, yeah.
Right.
I did. I mean, so many times. I mean, like in, I guess in my defense, there are many times in the dissertation, in my book, in articles where I'm like, Pradaya is so important and I just don't know enough about it, you know, like, because we can only do so much. So I did know, you know, I knew that, and I talked a lot with my colleague, Joe Pitayapon at Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok, who is a specialist on the history of Pradaya languages. We always had this dream of doing a project together where we resolved that. But, you know, scholarship is hard, and you have to read so much, you have to do so much research, which is why the academy is a collaborative place, you know? So it's not a bad thing when a scholar says, oh, this guy didn't get to this point, because that means then someone can come along and then take your work and then fill that hole. And that's exactly what this young, recent PhD from the University of Washington has done. So I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's the way the academy works. We do what we can. Nobody's work is perfect or exhaustive. And then that's also why when we do our work, we have to read other people's work so that we're not building from zero. We're building upon an edifice, you know, and we're building higher. So that's one type of disagreement with my work or criticism of my work that I wholeheartedly embrace. And I think it's healthy and important. There are other things that are more like, as we were talking about earlier, responses to my work that have to do with how much emotion we invest in things like language and identity. And I think I'm very sympathetic to that because, as I said in the beginning of our conversation, you know, like I started this whole journey with questions of identity. I care about identity. I think it's important and it's powerful. And I think, so I understand where those feelings are coming from. I understand how someone might look at my book and be like, you know, he doesn't care about Vietnam. He doesn't care about Vietnamese identity. He thinks we're all just Chinese. You know, that's totally untrue. But I understand that feeling, you know, and I really want to say that that's not what I'm saying. and that, you know, like, as we've said many times now in this conversation, if we can just loosen our grip a little bit on the rigidity of our concept of our own identities, that we can see how very rich our identity really is. And the last thing I'll say on this issue is that, like, it's true, you know, it's not just personal responses or scholarly, you know, lacunae. It's also that we, for much of the 20th century into the 21st century, we just are trained to think of history and culture in terms of discrete polygonal shapes on a map. I mean, you know, France is this hexagon on a map, and you're either French or you're not. Vietnam is this snake-like thing, and you're either Vietnamese or you're not. And you can put things in the basket of Vietnamese, and you can put things outside of that basket. That's just the way we're primed to think. And work like the work that I forward in the book, it challenges that. You know, it asks us to think not in those terms. And I think that rubs a lot of people the wrong way. And I get that too. I understand that, you know. But the hope is that, you know, people will see that we're not losing anything by letting go of that way of thinking. And one more thing also, like, a lot of the incredible scholarship of the 20th century on into the 21st century, it was working in that mode, as it was working in a kind of nationalist mode or a Cold War mode. And I want to say very clearly, like, that doesn't mean that scholarship is not incredible. Like, I owe all of us who are working in Vietnamese studies today, we owe everything to those generations who came before us, who laid that groundwork. So I think another way people get rubbed the wrong way is to think that we're ungrateful. And I actually really hate when scholars are ungrateful for the previous generations, because it's very easy, you know, to invent the next car once the car has been invented, you know, like, and there was just so much labor in those decades to open up, you know, Vietnamese studies, that we all owe to that labor. And just because we're moving past a framework that some of those scholars were operating under doesn't mean that we aren't using their scholarship, or that their scholarship doesn't comprise the foundation and much of the structure of what we call Vietnamese studies today.
I really appreciate how honest you are about the critiques of your work and how you could, you know, really talk so honestly about how we see scholarship in the past versus the future and the vision of sort of these advanced ways of learning, what, you know, there's new technical aspects to the research, or in hindsight, you know, you can turn back and you can see how clearer the modes of uncovering these different ideas are. I do want, and I hope that we can create this, you know, sub-series, because I think I'm not even a percent of like this itch that I have for this kind of, you know, this field. I studied anthropology, and, you know, we never really got to go deeply into linguistics. And I always regretted not sort of like taking that path to learn linguistics, because I've always been interested in it. But now it's like the itch for not only just linguistics, but because it's related to the Vietnamese history. And I want to learn it. I want to hear about it. I want to get into all of the nooks and crannies with everybody. And I want to ask the audience that after listening to this episode, if you have any thoughts, if you have anything that you would like us to focus on in future episodes, please leave it in the comments.
Well, thank you so much, Kenneth. This has been really fun. You know, as I mentioned, once again, you know, I, along with many people, I started my academic journey with a question about culture and identity. So the focus of your podcast is something that I care very deeply about. And I'm so glad that we had a chance to talk just about how my book, which is, you know, on a very obscure topic, you know, about the specific phonological history of Vietnamese, how that actually does relate to issues and questions about culture and identity. And I would love to do, you know, a sub-series on any of the aspects of the history of the Vietnamese or Chinese languages, culture, or society that you or, you know, your listeners might be.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, I'm sure you could sit there and create like a 15, 20 sub-series topics. You know, I mean, one for me already is really the different ethnic tribes that we have and the classification and all of the histories of that and how all of that. I think we brushed a little bit on it, but, you know, there's a mountain of more information that I'm sure that you could easily answer if we put our brains to it.
Yeah, well, I would be happy to. And I also want to say there are just a lot of people who are great experts on that range of issues, not only the ethnic minority languages and things, but also many other experts on exactly my field, on Sino-Vietnamese history, like, you know, Mark Alvis and Vietnamese phonology, Andrea Pham, just so many people. So, you know, like, I hope that we can bring the community together to share a little bit about that history. So thank you so much, Kenneth. It's been such a pleasure.
John, I really appreciate you. Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.